The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. So reliable, it just goes on and on and on.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, musician Dave McCabe talked to me about navigating setbacks with unshakable optimism after March saw the entertainment industry hit hard by COVID-19, and Dave himself received a shock diagnosis of leukemia. Lightweight amateur boxer and double world medalist Kelly Harrington spoke to me about the long lead up to the Tokyo Olympics and returning to work as a cleaner in St. Vincent's Hospital to help take the fight to coronavirus. Marguerite Penrose is someone who has embraced every challenge life has thrown at her. She told me her story of adoption, her time spent in hospital as a child, and how she's taking a stand against racism. And designer Laura Egan spoke to me about the world of fast fashion and why she left behind the brands to focus on upcycling and sustainable clothing. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it. Well, we all know that the entertainment and music industry has been hit hard these past few months, but I'm going to speak to someone now who's been dealt a very different class of curveball altogether. Dave McCabe, good morning to you.
How's it going, Ryan? You all right?
Very nice to talk to you. We heard about you from your mammy.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, she emailed us, didn't she?
She sure did. And yeah. So I know a little bit about you, but I'm going to ask you to share your story with us. You're how old and from where?
I'm Dave McCabe. I'm 24 and I'm from Walkinstown.
You were a musician in a band, Stolen City. Yeah. You also had another job, is that right?
I do, yeah. I work as an SNA in a school.
Brilliant.
In a secondary school.
So you were a busy man. And did you have, up until the story we're going to get to, did you have a great feeling about 2020?
Oh my God, yeah. It was meant to be. Like, I've been doing the band for 6 years now. We've been doing it for 6 years together. And we were waiting for a huge opportunity like this to come up for us. And yeah, so it was meant to be, 2020 was meant to be our biggest year, you know, our big shot. And we released a single in February. And it was a big single for us. It was called The Tower. And we were promoting this song all through the month of February. And then I started feeling like unbelievably tired. And then in March, everything just kind of hit the fan and all went downhill.
You started feeling tired, fatigued.
Yeah. Now, as I said, I've been doing this for 6 years with the band, and I'd never feel as tired as I was, and I was feeling unbelievably tired, run down. I was sleeping all the time. I started breaking out then in these bruises on my hands, bruises on my legs, and I broke out with these blood blisters in my mouth.
God.
So I went to the doctor, and he was like, it's called hand, foot, and mouth, what you have. And I was like, okay. I went to do bloods then on the Thursday. On the tours, they did me bloods. Friday, then I went to do a gig in a primary school. It was Mental Health Week in the primary school. And I was missing phone calls. Mm. And I was like, what's going on? It was James's Hospital trying to get in touch with me. Now, I literally had done the bloods Friday morning. James's Hospital were calling me. And it turned out I had to go straight into hospital. I was rushed straight in. It turned out I had this APML leukemia.
Oh,
so I got diagnosed with that, which was just on the 6th of March, which is just absolute madness, you know?
So you had done the bloods in the morning, and then your phone was hopping to say, we need to see you immediately. So when you got to the hospital, where did you go and what did they say to you?
I literally had gone into A&E, and I was like, I'm a relaxed person now, I'm chilled about this, like I wouldn't panic about anything, but I literally got into A&E, and they were like, what's your name there? It's like Dave McCabe. Like, oh, we have everything set up for you. Got me weight done, me height done. I was brought straight through and I met the doctor. And I was like, she goes to me, I'm not someone you want to see on a Friday afternoon. And I was like, okay. She was like, you have leukemia. And she explained everything out to me. And I was like, oh my God. Well, this is different, you know.
Did she mention anything about how serious it was?
Oh yeah, she said. So basically the bruises on my hands and the bruises on my legs and everything was that my body was bleeding and the blood wasn't clotting. And she said, this is extremely serious, she said. And she said, if you have a bleed to your brain, she's like, that's it, we have hours here. So it was literally, I was brought for a scan on my brain and then I got put onto chemo that night.
When she said we have hours here if things take a wrong turn, did she actually mean hours to live?
Hours to live, yeah, she did, yeah. Whew.
And how did you feel hearing that?
I was calm and chilled about the whole thing, and I tell you, when he was, my mom and dad were there with me, and they were absolutely like, yeah, of course parents don't want to hear the 23-year-old son has been diagnosed with leukemia, and all, so they were on edge, of course, like, but I was calm and I was trying to make sure that everybody else was okay, you know?
Yeah, you're one of those people. I like you.
I'm one of them. Yeah, I like you.
We need you around us, you know, when everyone else is losing their head, you know. But you kept the head, obviously, and they brought you in straight away to what? To chemo, is that what you said? Straight in?
You get all the PICC lines put in your arm and everything like that, and I was brought straight in and I've got an infusion of chemo. And this is all on the, like, I was literally doing a gig earlier that day.
Yeah.
You know, which is just crazy. And, like, brought into a room. And I'm the type of person that I was never even sick before this, you know.
Sure.
Like, I'd never go to the doctors. I'd never do anything like that. And then to find out this, and, like, straight onto chemotherapy that night. I was given tablets for to stop bleeding. I had a nurse in with me basically all night to check on me. It's just all madness, you know.
It does sound, you're probably kind of thinking, will I be out tomorrow for the gig that night, the next night?
That was it. Like, I had a gig. We were doing a gig for, it was the UCD Science Ball on the Saturday. And I was told by the doctor, she was like, this is extremely serious. And I was like, look, listen, I have a gig tomorrow night. Will I be able to get out to do the gig, please? And she was like, this is really serious. I don't think you understand here. I was like, oh, no, I do. It's just, gig's really important, you know.
Yeah, you may be the most optimistic man I've ever interviewed.
Oh, God.
Okay, let me get a handle then on how long you were in the hospital for, Dave.
So, yeah, I was in the hospital for 5 weeks. I got discharged on the 11th of April, which is mad because I got brought in on the 6th, yeah, and then I had maybe 3 days of visitors, and then lockdown happened, you know.
Really?
And then no one could come in to see me. So that was a big surprise, a big kind of shock as well, you know.
Did you bring any instruments with you to kind of kill off the...
I did. I brought a guitar with me and I was doing a good bit of writing, but it was all fair depressing there.
I'd say it was.
It was a small little room and I was like, oh, okay, so
yeah.
No one wants to hear that, you know.
Yeah, that was very much relating to your own experiences. I can imagine.
Yeah.
pretty heavy. How did you feel in the hospital? What a strange, surreal time to be locked down with chemo going on, cancer, all of this happening to you. It's just sort of when you were on the cusp of hopefully musical greatness.
Greatness.
How did you feel?
To be honest, I kept optimistic through the whole thing, you know, and I honest to God, I did, like, because I was locked up and it was the best way to be. Like, I'd never be a person to sit down and go, oh, woe is me, this is so difficult. I was kept, and you look forward to, like, stupid things, like, you know, I was in there, I had a set routine, I'd get up, I'd get bloods taken by a nurse, and then I'd get up and I'd go, now I had a tiny room, go for a little walk around the room, and then I'd have like a FaceTime to my mom and dad, and then I'd have a FaceTime to my girlfriend, you know.
Mm.
So I did, I kept the head up and kept the chin up and just kept going, and then obviously you'd have your off days where you just feel sick, like I had days where I couldn't even get out of bed, you know, but, you know, everything will pass, you know, everything will, you'll get through it all, you know.
You're some man, Dave, I have to say. I tell you, I wish I had a slice of that positivity would probably get me through for the rest of my life. But when were you released from your hospital prison?
I was released on the 11th of April to go home. I was home for 3 weeks and then I was readmitted in. I started this crazy chemotherapy. It was arsenic chemo. And I was readmitted. They wanted just to check me for a week, basically, on this stuff because it's so severe. So I was in for a week of that. I got out on the 3rd of May. The 13th of May, sorry, I got out of that. And I've been getting treated, like, I'm just going into James's twice a week now to get, like, the chemo and stuff like that. So, grand.
And how are you feeling about, in terms of your health, in the immediate future, what's happening?
Like, it was an extremely treatable type of leukemia. You know, what she said to me was, if you were to pick out, there's a line of leukemias, if you were to pick out one to get, you pick the right one. And I was like, oh, well, that's great anyway.
what a perverse choice to have to make.
Yeah. So it's extremely treatable. You know, as soon as I'll be finished all the treatment in November, and it should look like the nails hit on the head, you know. It's just a long road to get to that. But, you know, as I said, keep your head up, keep the chin up, keep on going.
What are your parents like?
See, I have my mom was diagnosed, she had breast cancer. You're looking at maybe 10 years ago.
Okay.
You know, so she'd be a Google doctor, you know, you'd call them. So she'd be Googling everything away there.
The worst thing you can do.
Oh, I'm telling you, she'd like looking up everything. And on the night getting chemo, she, obviously because of her breast cancer, she had chemo and everything. Mm-hmm. And my first night getting chemo, she was there. And she was the one that had to see me getting it done, you know. So I don't know how she felt. And I don't know how it would have felt for her going through it and seeing her son getting it. But, you know, I can't complain about my mum and dad at all. You know, they're extremely. And, you know, my mum was the one who got in touch with you to tell my story, you know. So they're great people, you know. And they were, if it's not for them, they're getting me through this whole thing as well, you know.
She was so proud. You want to see the email. It's like bursting with pride and joy and, you know, right down to, she was actually acting partly as your agent as well, talking about your new single called Sparks and, you know, have a look at Stolen City, Ryan, and what do you think we can do? Like all the young bands, this is your life. And there's so many people, Dave, like you and roadies and sound technicians and musicians and backing singers all over the country who found themselves falling off a cliff through a really hard time because not only financially but creatively difficult.
Yeah.
If you're a singer, you want to sing.
If you're a performer, you want to perform. That's it. You know, like it's mad. And we, as I said, it was the one time we had everything mapped out for us. You know, we had such a good future in line for us. And then, as I said, I got sick and then the world ended basically, you know, in March. We don't know what the story is now. Like we had a song recorded there, Sparks, and we released it during lockdown. So we'll see what the future holds because it's not just us in this situation, you know. It's everybody is in this situation. So that's the only upside to look at. So we'll see what happens in a few months, you know.
Well, if you're as sunny on stage as you are in the outer stages of leukemia talking to me on the radio, I'd say there are some gigs you perform. So I'm looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah, we do. We put on some show. Like, we put on a very live, energetic, upbeat show. So,
I believe it.
You can, Ryan, buzz along to one of the gigs.
That's what I'm up for it. So, just, I know you won't keep me posted, but your mammy will, so I'll be grand.
Yeah, I'll get me mad.
I know my audience, Dave. who else is in the band? Let's say hello to them.
There's a singer, Sean McGrath, and Ian Bailey. Ian's the drummer. I've known Ian years, and Ian's in the army. And do you know what they say about the drummers in the band? There's always a bit of a screw loose in them. Typical drummer.
Everyone needs a screw loose in their life, so you know that. Dave, I've really enjoyed talking to you. They call people like you in life a tonic, and you're one of those people. And here's to your great health. I look forward to meeting you. I really mean this in real life, hopefully in some class of or shape or form as a musician or whatever it might be. So look, go well, mind yourself, best to the folks, and stay strong and stay smiling because that's what you're good at.
That's it, Ryan. And I will indeed. And thank you very much for your time.
You're a gentleman. Nice to talk to you, Dave. Take it easy.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks
bye.
For now. That's what I would call a human ray of sunshine. Dave McCabe joining us on the radio this morning. The text number, as always, is 51551. At 9:33 this Tuesday morning, I'm joined this morning in studio by a woman who can only be described as a joy to chat to. She has two world championship medals under her belt and has her eyes set on Tokyo for the 2021 Olympics. We talked in the Late Late Show a number of weeks ago and she was telling me all about what she's up to. Her name is Kelly Harrington. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, Ryan. How's it going?
It's good to see you because, well, first of all, I think I'd like to introduce you to the non-boxing members of our audience this morning as to who you are, a little bit about yourself. So let's take it from the start. Who are you? Where were you born? And
so I'm Kelly Harrington. I'm from the northeast inner city, Dublin 1. I love my community. I'm very proud of where I come from. I started boxing when I was 14, 15, basically to get myself out of trouble because I was heading down that wrong way. And I haven't looked back since. It's been great for me.
So you're from 1 to, say, 12 or 13, just from what you've said there.
Yeah.
Were you a good kid? And
I was, like, well, I mean, when I was about 13, I started head down the wrong road. Like,
what happened?
Just doing things that kids wouldn't really do. Do you know, like, I had no sense of direction in my life. I suppose I was very confused. And I mean, when I say the world was against me, like, you know, everyone was against me. Like, obviously they weren't against me. But when you're that age, like, and your brain is developing and all that, you really do think, and sure, you think your man, dad and all is against you. Yeah. I was that kind of child. And I suppose, like, I just ended up getting into boxing because it was the only really thing around in the community was boxing. There's boxing clubs in every corner in the in Dublin One, really.
And how were you rebelling? How were you becoming a pain? I presume you became a pain.
Oh, it became, a thorn in my mat and dad's side.
What were you doing?
I won't really get into it, like, but I wasn't really being good. And it wasn't just like little simple things that you'd say, "Ah, God, she's only a child." I was a brat, like, basically. And anyone from the inner city who knows me, like, they all know what I was up to. I see plenty of kids going through the same thing now as what I did go through, and I like to be able to share my life story with them and try and change them, like, and even if it helps one person, then
okay. So you're going down this road, and there must have been was it one moment or somebody or something happened that said, "You know, Kelly, I can see everything in you. That's great. I can see all the potential, but you're going dark. We need to bring you back to the light."
To be honest with you, I was very, like, although I was only, say, like 14, although I was only a child, mm-hmm. I had an older head on my shoulders, and I was very streetwise. So my ma and dad would have always been on my case, and I eventually just knew what I was doing was wrong, mm-hmm. and I had to do something, I had to change. I got sent over to England to live with my auntie for 3 months.
Tish.
When I was, I think I might have been 15 at that stage. And when I came back, like, when I was in England, I really didn't like it. It was just very different, and I was able to kind of see what I was doing wasn't right, and wasn't right for me, Matt and Dad as well. So when I came home, I just really got into a club. But I was trying to get into a club anyways for ages at the start, because I knew what road I was going down was wrong, but I couldn't get into a club. But eventually when I got into a club, things just started to change.
But you said there were boxing clubs on every corner in Dublin One, but why couldn't you get into a club?
Because no clubs wanted to take girls. Yeah, no clubs would take females. And in fairness, like, they hadn't got the facilities for it, but, like, as in changing rooms and shower rooms. But when you're that age, you're not going to be showering in a club anyways. Yeah. Like, a lot of kids in my club now, they just go. Like, they just come training and they leave. So they don't really use as changing rooms anyways, or the shower rooms, you know. Like,
sure.
But
so you,
I think
you kept knocking
then,
on the door.
I just kept knocking. Yeah, there was a coach in the flats that I was hanging around, and there was a coach in there, and I'd see him coming in from training and going to training every day while I was hanging around in the flats. And I knew he was a coach of the club. So for a year, I used to, like, pester him, knock on his door and say, will they let me in now? Will they take me now? And eventually he just got, like, sick of it. So he says, all right, they're going to take you. And I had to train separate nights then to all the boys and the men and stuff. But
you were determined.
I was determined.
Why boxing, Kelly?
Because it was on every corner. It was so cheap. It was cheerful. Like, you didn't really even need to have your subs going in, you know. Like, you'd be like, oh yeah, like you'd be, they'd be like, Kelly, do you have your subs? And you're like, oh yeah, I'll get you next week. That was like week after week after week. Yeah. But and that's boxing, you see. It is cheap, it is cheerful, and coaches are doing it voluntarily, and they
community. That's what you were
saying.
You
know, that's exactly what it is, like.
So when did the good Kelly emerge from the bold one?
From the bad Kelly. Yeah. Like, it's okay to say that.
No, but I don't want to be judgy. Like, but I am curious to know, like, because you're such a force of goodness, I think. But I'm just curious to know, when did you leave that?
When did I leave that behind?
Yeah.
I'd say, like, when I was 15, I was really getting into boxing, and I was becoming part of a different family. And it wasn't the fact of who I was hanging around with, because a lot of people say, they're hanging around with a bad group, and they're hanging around with this, that and the other. For me, I was hanging around with who I wanted to hang around with. They didn't make me hang around with them. I hung around with them because I wanted to, do you know, like, and then it was me who stopped, like, not that I stopped hanging around with them. I just chose that I was going to do something different.
Yeah.
And I still speak to those people now and they're still my friends, and it's just, it's life choices, isn't it, really,
yeah,
what you choose to do. And I suppose at like 15 up, when I was in a club and I had a boxing family, that's when me life started to change. And
it changed radically, because suddenly you found yourself going, I'm actually quite good at this. And you started getting a bit of attention, obviously.
It wasn't even that, because I never thought I was good at it, but a lot of other people thought I was good at it. You know, I just had a natural ability to be light on my feet and fast, very flighty, really. And I think coaches then just added their little bits in here and there and kind of made me a different type of boxer. But I started to believe it then when... Only in 2016, like, that's a long time after you get into boxing to start believing that you're actually somewhat good. And then when I got my first medal, then I just started to smell the roses and see, oh God, there's actually something good coming out of this, and just kept my head down then.
Do you remember the first medal?
Yeah, it was the Worlds in Kazakhstan in 2016, because I had said at the start of the year, right, I'm boxing. I think at that stage I'd been boxing 10 years, and I was like, I got into boxing to get me out of trouble, and I knew when I stop, I know now when I stop boxing, I'm not going to go back to doing, getting into trouble, you know, like, so at that stage in 2016, I was like, look, give it everything for the next few months, put everything into what you're doing, and if you medal out here, great. If you don't, at least you have given everything. So that's exactly what I done. I was working full time in the hospital, and I was working in a gym as well. And I just gave it absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And then when I went out to Kazakhstan and I got a medal out there, I couldn't believe it. And then I really started to believe that if I do put my time and effort and all my energy into something, that you can achieve it. You know, it was the only time when I really, really knuckled down and when someone actually believed in me. And then after that, then sure, everybody believes in you. Once you get a medal, then everybody jumps on the bandwagon,
yeah,
really, you know, like, that's the way it is. Like, and things have just been great. Things just seem to keep blossoming, really. Like,
yeah, and you keep winning and achieving.
That's it. But the thing about it is, like, I was only saying there, I feel now, if I was to walk away from boxing, I feel like I have accomplished a lot. You know, I know there's still the Olympic Games and that is a dream, but while it's a dream, it hasn't been a dream since I've been a kid to go to the Olympics, because, like I said, it was to get out of trouble. But now, as I'm getting older and I see that I am decent, I realise, Jesus, I could actually make an Olympic Games. Like, I could try and my best to go for it. But if it didn't happen, like, I've still accomplished a lot and I'm still happy, and I'm not afraid to walk away from boxing. And like, I don't think that, I know I'm not going to go back to the way I was, you know, so I'm happy enough. Like,
it's
happy,
like,
where I am.
It's like a bonus system. It's a bonus to be a boxer. It's a bonus to win a medal in Kazakhstan, and it's a bonus to qualify for that. You know, is it like that?
That's exactly what it is. Everything is a bonus now from here out. Like,
that's a real winning formula, though, because you can't lose.
That's exactly it. You can't lose. Like, and I have great people around me who, like, Just days where I feel like I haven't drank in 4 years, you know, like,
yeah.
And
good on you, by the way.
Like, over the last couple of months, I'd love to go out and just let the hair down, and have great people around me who are saying, "What's the point, Kelly? Like, you know, you don't need to. Like, you're on the right track. Keep going, you know." Like, and I'm like, "Yeah, you're right. Like, because I'll only end up bloody sick anyways the next day. So, what's the point in doing it?" So, and I mean, I have all the time after the Olympics to go out if I want to. So
you're just keeping yourself.
Just keeping myself.
My body's a temple. You know,
exactly.
I keep that going.
I can eat all the chocolate in the world, but that's it.
Can you actually?
Well, like, probably, like, I'm 6 kilos over my weight at the moment, but I'll start cutting it down.
Half the country is at least 6 kilos over the weight. But, Gemma, you're working throughout COVID. You've been working doing what? Remind us.
So I'm working in St. Vincent's in Fairview. I'm a cleaner in there. I love my job. I love the patients. Well, I'll rephrase that. Maybe I don't actually love the job itself, but I love the patients in there. And I love that I get to be around the patients in there and shine a bit of light on their day. And
What time is your day? What time is your shift normally?
It starts at 8.
8. And when you get in there, 8 to what?
8 to 1.
And what typically do you have to do cleaning wise? Are you using the...
So,
the Hoover or the big machines or whatever.
So we have Hoovers, mops. We have everything basically. Yeah. All the sprays. Like there's millions of sprays around now. Everything. But I just get in and I just get stuck in from the time I get in, and then I try and get it done as quick as I can, so I can spend a bit of time then like having the crack with the patients really.
And what class of hospital is
it's a psychiatric
in?
Hospital.
Okay, and you're in there between I'm in there, and 1.
So during the COVID I was in there 7 days 1 week and then 3 days the next week, and I was only in from 9:30 to 1:30 at that stage. But that's gone now because they don't really need me that much anymore. As far as I'm aware, we haven't had any COVID patients in there, which is absolutely amazing.
Like, were you worried when the rest of the world was worried at the early stages as a cleaner, particularly going in? Or did you mask up more than everyone else and, you know, PPE and all the rest of it? Or how did you feel? You're shaking heads. Are you mad?
Yeah, like obviously I'm worried because, like, I'm not one of these people who think it's some kind of a conspiracy or anything, because I know it's real, like, it's happening, you know?
Absolutely, yes.
But I was just, like... I was just going about my day being normal, like wearing my gloves, and like because I wasn't on my normal ward, I was on the COVID ward, and I wasn't near any patients or anything. But if I was coming into close contact with someone, I would have a mask on me. But apart from that, I kept going, just kept doing it. You have to keep living, don't you?
You have to keep going.
You know, like, life goes on.
Do you have, can you tell me why you enjoy the patients' company so much?
I think they make me feel normal.
I'd say you tell them that too.
And that's the thing. Like, when I go in there and like I can do anything, and they get a great laugh off me. Like, and
because you're acting the maggot.
Because I'm acting the maggot. Yeah. You know. And like we had a karaoke. It's gone now. Actually, they got rid of the karaoke because it was broke. We broke it. But we had a karaoke.
What's your go to song?
Young Hearts.
Young Hearts, Run Free.
Yeah.
Okay. Good choice.
So I would we'd go in and we'd whack the karaoke on, and we'd be up and we'd be singing, and it'd be up full whack, and God love the poor nurses having to listen to us, you know.
Like, and I saw footage of you there doing this is the shadow boxing thing.
Oh God.
What is that? What is that? Is that that's an international competition?
It was. Because obviously there's been no sports, no boxing over the whole COVID. So there was the European shadow boxing competition. And it was
I'd be deadly at that.
You would actually. You should give it a go.
I'm
gonna
lie,
hope you got that recorded.
No, we don't have cameras here. Keep going.
So it was countries from all over Europe, and thousands of people like put it in. But I have some imagination, so I was like, right, we'll do it in work, because I only bring my speaker into work, and I do get the staff, like the household staff and stuff, and the catering staff, we'd be up and dancing and stuff. So I told them what it was. I told them it was the European Shadow Boxing Championship, and I wanted to win it. And they were like, right. So I came in, I brought my speaker in, but then it started growing. One of the workers were like, oh, I'll be the card girl, and then another one was like, I'll ring the bell on the milk jug, and I was like, all right. But it comes back. I didn't hear anything for
how many people
for a while.
Were taking part.
I don't know, like there was a good few people, like it was all staff anyways, but it was a good few people, and everyone got great crack out of it. Like, everyone was smiling and getting great joy out of it.
Were there many people competing for this? Competing for it.
There was thousands, like.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's European, like, and there were so many people.
You're in the kind of the dining room, shadow boxing, you know, look, nearly the staff and the friends are kind of ducking out of your shadow punches. Who won it?
I won it. I got the gold. I got a. I'm European gold medalist, shadow boxing champion, without a glove landing on my face or landing on my opponent's face.
Not a bruise to show for.
Oh, I tell you. But the thing about it is, you know, when like sort of was music playing and I was doing the shadow boxing, and all the work colleagues, they were all going.
Yeah, I saw.
You want to see how many takes we had to do, because everyone was out of sync. It was, I tell you.
It's just
it was
like the Late Late Show audience. Okay, let me ask you. Mandy, Tell me about Mandy.
So we're together now 10 years. Yeah.
10 years. How old are you now?
A long time. I'm 30 now.
Yeah. Are you really? Yeah. God, what, I would have knocked at least 8 years off.
Oh,
that.
Jesus, thanks very much. We're friends for life now, Ryan.
No, I really mean it. You're really kind of like young looking. But go on anyway. So yourself and Mandy, you're 10 years together.
Yeah, so she's been with me since the start, really. Since my first National Elite title, she's been with me.
And how did you meet?
She's boxed as well, because she was boxing in a club out in Bray, and I had to go out and train out there for squad training. I didn't really like it, but look, I went out anyways. She was out there with her kickboxing bombs on her, hitting the bag, and I was like, look at her, she really thinks she's it, doesn't she? And then after, like, it's just mad how things happen. Like, and she met a friend of mine in the George one night or something, and I had Mandy's phone number, and my friend was at the telling me, and I text her and I was like, oh, what are you doing out in the George? And then ever since that, we've been together.
Because I remember when I interviewed you on the Skype or whatever for the Late Late, and you said as soon as the interview finished and we stopped, and people at home didn't necessarily see it, but you took your foot off. I thought, was that Mandy? Shut up, man. But actually, it was your dog.
Oh, God, the amount of people who were like, wait, did you really have your foot on Nidge's head? I was like, no.
Yeah. So your dog Nidge is obviously named after Tom Vaughan Lawler's character in
Love Hate. Because it's a love-hate relationship. He only uses us for food and rubs, that's all.
Yeah. And what class of a dog is he? Kind of a bulldog? Or?
He's a little Frenchie. He's a French bulldog. You want to hear the noise out of him and the farts out of him. Oh my God, he's stinking.
And you keep him.
And we keep him. We love him though. That's the thing. We love that, but we hate the farts. So yeah, that's it. Love hate. Oh God.
What's the story then with the Olympics are now Tokyo 2021? You've kind of set the record there. You obviously your dream, you want to be there, you want to box, you'd like.
I really want to be there. Like, I want, this is the next, I have two world medals, I've European medals. This is the next medal that I should have, is an Olympic medal. Not I should have, if I work for
you'd
it
like
and
it.
You work hard.
Yeah.
I would love it. Like, I'd like it.
Come here, are your parents gorgeous people like you are?
Yeah.
I mean, is that where you got it from? Because they had to be strong for you when you were a brat.
Yeah.
And they had to be good for you when you were coming out the other side. And they must be the proudest people in Ireland.
Yeah, I always feel like every time I win a medal, I feel like I'm making up for everything that I put my mat and that through. It's mad, but that is what I feel, you know. And they're the first people that I ring when I step out of the ring. They're the first people that I pick the phone up and ring. My dad actually worked in the hospital with me as well.
Really?
Now he's up in a different place now, part of the HSE. But it's what you get is what you see with us, really.
You're just I'm so glad we got to meet up today, because you're everything and expected and more, which is even
thanks
better.
Thanks very much.
No, I really
Ryan.
Mean it.
Thank you.
You're one of my new favorite people. Which is great. In terms of the future, obviously we'll look at the boxing and see how that goes. Folks are happy. You've done your frontline service, and you know, you just seem to be a pretty happy person. And one last thing I wanted to ask you about was, because it was one of the first things out of your mouth this morning when you sat down in front of me, which was, you know, you said, my name's Kelly Harrington and I love my community. What is it about, why did you say that?
It's, you know, we're in a community where everyone is so close, and if something happens to one family, if someone gets sick or something like that, everybody gets behind it in the community. Mm. It's such a tight knit. Obviously, we've had our ups and downs as a community, but what community hasn't? You know what I mean? It's just we seem to get more limelight because we're from the inner city, but the amount of good things that happen in there, it's absolutely amazing. I'm actually doing a class now on every Monday morning at 8:30. It started as an over 50s class, but then I just started to call it an adult class. But it's amazing because we have neighbours now on the road who probably haven't really talked to each other since we've been kids, you know, and they're all back out and they're all chatting away. And I have a nun now who comes from my job. Yeah, Sister Angela. I know she's listening in there. So hello.
You're getting the full blessing.
I'm getting the full blessing during the session.
And your mother?
Everything. And my ma's there. And it's very hard to do the session because my ma's there, because I do a lot of shadow boxing and stuff. And when I look at my ma shadow boxing, I'm nearly on the deck laughing. Like, it's hilarious. But when it, the thing about it is, like, everybody be chatting after it, and when they're leaving, like, they all look like teenagers. They're pepping their step leaving, and it makes me feel good that they're feeling good.
They got up, they got out, they got talking.
Exactly, that's exactly it. You know, like, and it's only 30 minutes. That's all it is. Like, and yeah, it leaves them then that way, wanting to come back next week because they're like, I could have done an hour of that, and you're like, yeah, well, that's the point. We want you coming back next week. So, do you know, like,
you're amazing. You're just like Dave yesterday, who I spoke to. You're also a tonic, which is great, and a lot of the love for you coming in from people listening today, just about how upbeat you're making them feel. In fact, one said, I was feeling a bit down this morning, a bit down in the dumps, and now completely cheered up by Kelly. So you have,
thanks very much.
You have this infectious personality, there's no doubt about it. Such a great young woman, a tonic, love to her and her family. Marvellous to hear a normal, down-to-earth person with and a sense of humour on radio with you. You sound like best friends. Well, that's not true.
Because we're the three best friends that anyone could ever have.
I'll never see you again. You take yourself and Mandy and Nidge and beat it.
Oh, God.
What a way to end an interview, eh? Yeah. All right, Kelly, let's do this again, either here or on the Late Late.
Brilliant.
If you're okay with that.
Brilliant, yeah.
You can bring
absolutely
in the family.
Thanks for having me. Bring Nidge. I have to bring Nidge now.
I know, you can leave Nidge at home. Or at least outside. Outside the front, by the sounds of it. It's a flatulence issue. Well, it might be a problem for us. Kelly, listen, good luck with everything that you
do.
Ryan, and
thanks
for spreading a little sunshine on a dark time. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Mind
thanks
yourself. It's 9:28. It's Wednesday morning. Very, very good to have you here with us this morning. I'm joined in the studio this morning by someone who has risen above and indeed embraced every challenge life has thrown at her. It's a story of family bonds. It is a story of empathy. It's a story of incredible commitment and energy. And it is Marguerite Penrose's story. Good morning, Marguerite.
Good morning, Ryan. How are
very
you?
Very nice to meet you.
Thanks a million. And yourself?
I've seen you busy away, working away on Instagram, getting your message out to people. And here we are in real life. This is one of the reasons I love my job, is you can go from the cloud to the studio.
Yes, voila, here I am.
And here you are. Let's begin at the beginning. You were born when, where, and give us the early years. Would you mind?
Sure, no problem. I was born in January 1974, way back then. I was actually born in St. Patrick's Children's Home, which was a Magdalene laundry.
Okay.
So I am adopted now. So my first 3 years of life were living in the Magdalene laundry. On the Navan Road.
It's funny because we're essentially the same age.
Yeah, I know.
And when I hear Magdalene Laundry, I think 1950s.
I know.
Do people say that to
you?
Yeah.
I only found out recently where I was actually a laundry. I didn't realise that, nor my parents for years. So, yeah, it does seem like something that would be like way before 1974, yeah.
And you were there between the ages of 1 and 3, essentially.
1 and 3.
0 and
yeah,
3.
That's it.
I can't imagine you have even a bit of a memory of that, do you?
I have one very distant memory, yeah, of standing in what they called cribs at the time. But that's it, unfortunately. I don't.
Okay.
Well, I suppose not many people from that age
will
remember a lot.
That far back. Can I ask you then to kind of reach into your prehistory, if you like, as to how you ended up in that particular institution?
Yeah. Well, I have my biological mother is Irish, allegedly from Crumlin. So she basically fell pregnant. My father, as far as I know, my biological father, was in the army, the medical corps in Zambia. And he had travelled to Ireland with a couple of his fellow army officers. And they seemingly were based in the Curra so that would have been 1973. Somehow my biological mother and father met. I'm not sure of the full details. I have very, very little information. They met and my mother became pregnant. Now, seemingly in the meantime, my biological father went back to Zambia. He was only stationed here for a while. My mother came from a very working class background. As far as I know, there were 7 children, including herself. So she'd 5 older brothers and 1 younger sister. So she was the 2nd youngest in the family. Her parents were quite elderly and quite ill, from what we know at the time. 1974, as you can imagine, she'd had a relationship with a black man. So it wasn't probably the done thing, as they say. So I suppose for what I have in my head is that the best thing she could do for me was to put me up for adoption. So as far as I don't know whether she realised how long I would be waiting. I was actually fostered first by my mum and dad. That was in 3 years, so 1977.
So you seem to have quite a lot of information about your biological parents.
That's it, really.
Yeah, you've told me everything.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's very hard in Ireland. It's a whole other topic, really, the adoption situation over here. Obviously, yeah, you can't be just given a piece of paper and said, well, this is where they live or whatever. But it's extremely difficult to get information. Everything is under lock and key.
Yeah.
I don't even have records of my medical side of, you know, my biological parents' medical records. So anytime I have to go into hospital, the first question that, as people know, anybody who's been to the doctor or hospital are asked, what is your family medical background?
Yeah.
So that's, I'm not privileged to that information.
That's quite shocking.
It wasn't a given.
You can have all the anonymity in the world you want, but tell us the medical issues, you know.
Like it's nearly, you know, I think it's your basic human right to know this information.
Yeah.
Not only that, the most shocking is your birth certificate. I actually only got my original birth certificate, my own birth certificate, last year. So I've spent 45 years
fighting for it.
Fighting in the background. Yeah, with all the, there's so many adoption groups out there that are doing amazing work. I actually got mine accidentally. There's no such thing as an accident in my life, in my terms, but I stumbled across how I got mine.
Okay.
So basically, when you're adopted, you're given an adoptive birth certificate. So you don't have any information on it, really. So you've no access to anything, really. So you are what they say on that piece of paper.
Your biological father, and I want to move on in a second, because we're not here to talk about your adoption story in some ways, but we are talking about your life story, which is absolutely fascinating. And because he was so specifically from Zambia on a visit to the Irish Medical Corps in 1970, let's say, you could probably whittle with a bit of a dig around an archive.
I've done a little bit of research online.
If you wanted to.
Yeah. No, I am interested. It is, they are my parents at the end of the day. They're the other half of me. I'm very blessed that I have two completely different ancestral sides. You know, I have my Irish ancestors and then I have my Zambian ancestors. So it's always going to be a big interest to me. And, you know, there's something always within anybody of you, ask them that are adopted.
Go on.
It's part of your life. You know, it's part of me that I'm missing that I don't know about.
And the curiosity.
Curiosity. Absolutely. Like, I have amazing parents. They would always said to me from a younger age, if you ever want to trace your parents, were happy, like they'd nearly be more delighted than I would, I think, really.
Amazing.
You know?
So you hit the jackpot with your fostering, didn't you?
Absolutely.
At the age of three.
Yeah.
And will you tell me about those lovely people?
Sure, no problem. So basically how it came around was my dad was visiting his auntie and her next door neighbour was actually a nurse where I was in St. Patrick's.
Mm-hmm.
So she was in having a cup of tea with my auntie at the time and she just said, Michael, just wondering, we're looking for families to take children out for Christmas time, wondering would yourself and Olin be interested? So my dad said, oh, sure, I'll go home and ask Olin. So home we went and said it to mum and she said, yes, they agreed. So I have a sister, Kira.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually the same age. I'm just 3 months older than her.
Okay.
So it was agreed and the meeting was set up and everything like that. So I was supposed to come to them on Christmas Day. But unfortunately, I wasn't well. I was quite sick since I was born.
Okay.
So that didn't take place. So obviously, everyone was disappointed. But I actually came the next day, Stephen's Day. And then from then on, that was it. I was fostered up to the age of, because of my medical condition, I have congenital scoliosis. So it's curvature of the spine since birth.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, I was held within the system for medical reasons. Although I lived with my parents all the time. So
you became part of Michael and Nolene's and Kira's family.
Yes, exactly.
I'm just looking at the name Nolene
on
Christmas Day.
Christmas,
it's like little Christmas.
She's at the 31st of December, my mum's birthday.
Is that right?
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
And you landed on Stephen's Day.
I landed on Stephen's Day. It was all meant to be.
What
the stars aligned.
Yeah, but it must make Christmas very special in your house.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you know, it's so weird because sometimes you don't actually think about the adoption side.
Of course.
Because it's so much a part of my life now and my parents are my parents. Yes, I always, especially coming up to your birthday, you do get a weird feeling in you because, you know, there's a part of you that is not there to kind of say, oh, you know, OK, it's your birthday. But I know deep down that anybody that has to give up a child, they're always going to think about them all the time. So yeah. I'm sure it's as hard for them too, you know. So
of course. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you were born with congenital scoliosis.
Yeah.
What does that mean at a physical level for you on a day-to-day basis?
Well, it's a curvature of the spine. So for me, mine was quite severe when I was born. So literally from birth, I've had so many surgeries over the years. I ended up having, I was born without three ribs on my left-hand side. So I had to get them artificially made. They're actually made by a dentist, if you would believe that. I know, yes.
Wow.
So I had that surgery, I think, when I was about five.
Okay.
So coming to mum and dad, I had a lot of complications. So I was unwell. Thankfully, now I'm a lot more healthier. But I then had spinal fusion surgery, where they insert a metal rod into your spine to straighten it. So I had that. But then after a week of the surgery, it was actually mum that noticed that I hadn't moved my legs. I was on a Stryker bed. I don't know whether you know about that.
No.
So it's basically a bed that turns you. You can't turn yourself because
okay.
you have to lie quite still for a length of time till the healing takes place. So when that was noticed, the doctor came in and examined me and they confirmed, yeah, I was actually paralysed from the waist down from the surgery. So I had to have emergency surgery to take the rod out. And which was a pity because it had straightened my spine.
Yes.
You know, almost, I don't like to use the word perfectly, but we'll use it in this term.
Sure. But they had to take it out.
They had to take it
and
out.
We're back to...
Because of the paralysis, yeah.
Oh, no.
And I was still, unfortunately, paralysed after the rod came out. So I was nearly, I think I was 9 months in hospital altogether.
Yes.
When this happened. And then mum and dad said, is this going to improve? I'd had... lots of, you know, physical therapy,
sure.
everything like that. So they said, no, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like. So mum said, right, let's take her home now. She's been here long enough. So then just through determination, again, with my parents and sister, family and friends, I kept at it, kept trying to walk. And so it was about nearly 2 years later, I think, when I did actually take a first step.
And you had been a wheelchair user.
Wheelchair,
did you think you were going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life?
For the rest of my life, yeah.
That's amazing. And you took your first step. Were you determined or was it the folks willing you on? I mean, were you...
I don't know. I think when things like this happen to people,
this
strength comes from within you. Mm. You know, it's either do or die, really, you know. Quite a strong person. I am a strong person. I know I am. Just determination and... I don't know, you always have a feeling. I just knew, right, I'll keep going. And obviously then with the support of everybody egging you on. So, yeah.
Get over the line.
That was a very slow process when I did even take the first step. But here, you saw me walk in studio today.
I saw
today.
You walking in, chipper and happy and resplendent in orange. And saying, right, let's do this. And fighting talk.
Yeah.
You know, what is so far... We haven't even got to kind of the crux of why we're here today.
Yeah.
And yet it's only because your life has taken all these twists and turns mm-hmm. along the way the whole time. But let's get to the point that your parents, I don't know if they had to sit you down, Marguerite, or how it worked, but they decided, we just want to talk to you about the obvious.
Yeah.
Would you tell me about that?
Yeah, sure. To be honest, it was a very natural flow. I don't remember... not knowing I was adopted or fostered, as we say at that time. They always were very honest with me. If anything, I was like overly spoilt as well. You know, I was, as I was saying there in the article that I'd written, that I was the only black person that I'd ever seen. I hadn't seen anybody else up to when I went to secondary school. So that was, say, the first 12 years of my life was to be the only person to stand out. So mum and dad would always prep me when I was going somewhere, you know, don't mind if people stare at you. They just think you're lovely and they're just fascinated as to where you're from. So they were great that way because I never actually felt, you know, oh God, I have to do this by myself. They were always by my side and my sister was one of my biggest protectors. Like, God love anybody that looked crooked at me, you know. She'd be like, what's happening, you know. She would always defend me, so...
Had you had any problems regarding the colour and the like as a child?
I can't say no. Yeah, I would have had issues more, you know, staring is not as bad because people are curious and that's fine. You know, there's no issues with that. And there would have been people, yeah, that didn't understand, couldn't understand why two white people had like a black daughter and a white daughter, you know. So there was always, like, I remember people would be looking.
Yeah.
You know, they would be.
You remember the staring.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Sure. Exactly. And, you know, my poor parents had to have a chat with me everywhere we went, even though I was well aware. Mum would say, now you just remember that, you know, don't mind if anybody stares at you. People would come over and say things as well. You know, they'd be touching your hair. I'd really afro hair when I was younger as well. A bit like Michael Jackson in his younger years.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was. There would have been issues, like nothing too bad at that, because I was a child basically back then.
And then you start hitting 12, 13, 40, adolescence.
Yeah.
Tough time anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But add the 80s and add a lack of worldliness to the Irish culture.
Community and cultures, yeah, yeah.
What did you face into then, Marguerite?
School was great, I have to say. I went to Santa Sabina in Sutton. Okay. As I said, I met the first person of similar colour to me, my friend Catherine Shake. Her dad was Indian and her mum was Irish. So I couldn't believe this. I was like, oh my God, I'm not the only person here.
Yeah.
I didn't feel as much. You always have a sense of when you're going somewhere, gosh, do they know I'm black? Do they know I'm mixed race?
Yes.
These things run through your head just naturally because you are different. So school was great. As I started kind of going to the time of going out, you know, socially to pubs and things like that, that's when kind of the issues started, because obviously, you know, our public transport, say, like, I absolutely detest it.
Why?
Because I've been spat at. People go to sit down beside you and then they look and they won't sit beside you.
Why wouldn't they sit beside you?
Just because they obviously have an issue.
But what the hell is wrong?
Fear, like, I think.
Of what?
Of it not being the same as everybody else, even though we're all different. We're all uniquely unique. Yeah, so it's sad, really. So that's really the point of me telling my story, to try and help everybody that's coming through.
Let me take a step back.
Yeah.
When somebody spits at you.
Yeah.
And you feel their spit hit your skin.
Yeah.
What does that feel like?
It's probably one of the worst feelings in the world. Because you can't understand. Like, I remember thinking, why would they just dislike me just because I'm a different colour? Like, I haven't said anything to them. I'm not an aggressive person, you know.
Yeah. Look at
you.
Yeah.
Go on. So, yeah. So, I think it's fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
It's a learned thing as well. So, this is the reason that, like, we all have to educate ourselves. You know, they might have heard a story about such and such. You know, in Ireland, how these things go. We are the most welcoming nation. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely love being Irish. Love the fact I'm born here. Love the colour of my skin. Never wanted to be white.
Yeah.
Always loved that fact that, you know, that this was my colour skin. This was me. So I think really a lot of it, years ago, I would have said ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
There's no excuse anymore. As you said, we have everything at our fingertips now. Technology, we can read up on anything, you know. It's so multicultural in Ireland, so I don't understand why such racism still exists now.
Is it still alive and unwell, as you see it? And can you tell me about that? Because you've been, obviously, I mean, a lot of this kicked off for the media.
Yeah, yeah.
People like me.
Yeah.
When George Floyd was killed.
Yeah.
Suddenly, people started talking in a way that we hadn't talked about for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Marguerite, you came out and started talking about it. A lot of other people did in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, it felt like it's about time.
Yeah, definitely.
And I was kind of relieved almost that we can now. We
publicly talk about it, yeah.
Is that what happened with you, or, you know, did you?
It is, really. Like, when obviously you're black, you're mixed race, you're from somewhere different, or, you know, your skin is a different colour, your hair is a different texture, you're always fighting a battle, really, because it's like you nearly have to prove yourself sometimes, which then you get annoyed with yourself because you're like, well, I'm a good person, I shouldn't have to prove myself to anyone. But I think when the murder of George Floyd was definitely, you know, it's sad that somebody had to lose their life, and not just him. There's hundreds before him, thousands. There's been people since. But as I think it was Will Smith that said, that there's always been racism. The difference now is it's been filmed. So as we were talking just before we came on there about social media, that is a positive, because now people can't hide. There's photographs, there's video evidence, there's news evidence. But still, you've seen the evidence of people, you know, been murdered on the street, and everyone's been filmed.
There could have been
still going on.
Exactly, there could have been 50 George Floyds in the 1970s, or particularly 50s or 40s, and before that. But now, with cameras and everything, this is the upside of it, that you can see the upside of a horrible story that it's filmed. What I was hearing when these things were being discussed in Ireland was that for people, and again, even the language, if I said people of colour, am I in trouble?
I know. That's one thing that, you know, I'm sure you've read the story that I wrote there.
Yeah.
My view of coming from it is, don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to speak, because so many people have come to me and said, I'm literally afraid to say anything now in case it's not the right thing.
And I could be cancelled for saying you're a black woman or you're of woman of colour. You know,
I know. And that's another word that I've preached about, the cancel thing.
Culture.
We need to stop it.
Yeah.
I was only with my friends there at Stephen and Sandra's on Sunday and we were talking, and, you know, I was saying I was coming on here, and Stephen was saying, he said, I feel like if I say something wrong, you know, it's the worst thing in the world. So he said, I know how other people are feeling, because people are afraid, and I've had so many messages. So for me personally speaking, I think don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to ask questions. It's obviously the way you deliver what you're asking, you know. Do you mind if I ask you? You know, ask the person's permission, like I would if I was speaking to yourself.
I think you're describing what used to be called good manners.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
Old-fashioned
manners,
yeah. But you came, you described yourself, you wrote in the Black and Irish page on Instagram, and about these things.
Yeah.
And the most common question that people, black Irish people get is, no, but where are you really from?
Yeah.
I find that hilarious, because you could often say to somebody, if they're from Poland and they're heavily accented, you might say, where are you from originally?
Yes, exactly.
I think that's probably
best. That's so much better way of saying
really,
it.
I'm really curious to know, first of all, you know, wherever you have to get, you love the diversity because it's enriching the tapestry of the country. But you'd like to know also, if I was an immigrant in Boston at the turn of the last century, when somebody said, I can hear your accent, where are you from originally? I said, well, I'm from a place called Dublin and so on. So I don't think it's an unfair question.
No, the question is perfectly okay. It's the way, as you said, it's the terminology that's used. Like I would say to somebody, oh, where are you from? You know, Cork, wherever. So it's accepting the answer that you're given is the message. So
I wouldn't ask you.
People
sorry,
say to me,
I wouldn't ask you the question, because I'd hear your accent and say, "Well, you're dumb." But you know what I mean.
But so many people do.
They do. They ask you.
Oh, all the time.
Okay.
All the time. They would say so, and like that. I always say Dublin because I'm a dub, and then you can see in their eyes that there's another question coming. Now, half the time I'll say I'm from Dublin, but you know, I'm half Zambian, and that kind of cuts that out.
Yeah.
That's like kind of me giving you a helping hand.
Sometimes you play with them, do you?
Yeah, and it's curiosity. But then people just won't leave it alone. You know, they'll keep questioning you. And it is like the personal questions that you're asked.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't ask people half the things.
Yeah.
So it's an invasion of privacy, really.
Exactly. So why should you be allowed to get that line of questioning? So it comes down to, I was talking to Conor Buckley, it's about similar.
Oh, yeah. No,
you know, Conor, he's wonderful. He was talking to us recently.
His mum is absolutely a hero.
Yeah, I can believe it.
Yeah, such admiration for that woman.
And it all comes down to, like so many things, when it comes to the subject of ignorance or race, is education.
Education is the key.
Every time.
Yeah. And it seems so simple, but what is so complicated about it? But I think, like, you know, I've had so many discussions over the last few weeks about this. And basically, it's up to everyone. It's up to parents, grandparents. It's up to schools. And I don't mean just putting it on teachers. There's no proper curriculum. There's no anti-racism laws in Ireland, you know, hate crime laws. There's no, you know, in school, there's anti-bullying policies. Kids have to sign and everything. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about being anti-racist.
Yeah.
So and that's the message I'm trying to get across, is that we need to declare ourselves anti-racist. It's not good enough to presume everybody thinks you're not a racist. That doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
You actually have to say, do you know what? I'm anti-racist. And if somebody says something,
call them out.
Call them out, yeah. You know.
I see that the Taoiseach appointed a member of the travelling community to be a senator.
Yes.
And one of the first things she said, I heard her talking to Miriam McCallaghan on the radio the other day, and she was saying hate crime was on the, at the top
Thank
of her
God.
So this is good news. Let me take a few comments before we go, because there's a lot of love for you on the...
Oh, is there? Yeah. Oh, thanks everybody.
I was thinking, referring to Eileen Flynn there a minute ago, who's our new senator, so good luck to her in her endeavours. But what a wonderful woman. So sorry to hear the abuse you suffered at the hand of idiots. Kate says, your guest sounds like someone who brings sunshine wherever she goes. It's great to hear her. And God Ryan says another, I'm ashamed of the human race that we can be so awful to some people. I wish I could hug that lovely lady and tell her she is beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
And big hello to Mags. That's somebody who knows you.
Yeah.
I call you Marguerite, they call you Mag.
Yeah.
From her neighbour from Portmarnock in Niall Sunderland.
Oh, Niall Sunderland. Yeah, I know.
We had a great crack growing up on Wheatfield Road. Nothing stopped her from heading to Joe Mango's. That's obviously, is that Tomango's? That's the nickname for Tomango's, where the gang still goes?
That's it, exactly.
So you still went rocking and rolling.
Absolutely.
Of course,
why
wouldn't you? You're going to throw a ball once, as soon as everything calms down.
Yes.
Can you tell me what it is?
Sure, no problem. So I'm coming at this from a positive angle, as in educating people.
Sure.
The greatest thing that we've all been learning lately, especially since Caroline Flack's death, is kindness, compassion, empathy. So the feedback I've gotten is people are interested in my story in particular because I'm not angry. I'm not shouting. I'm getting a message across without putting the fear of God in people's lovely say. So I've been working on a little project, because I was thinking, well, how can I keep this up myself? What can I do?
Sure.
So it's about celebrating, is what I came up with. So I'm holding the first ever Black Lives Matter, I suppose, Irish black tie charity ball next year. It's inclusive of everybody. So we want to see all races, all creeds, everybody.
It's for human beings.
Exactly. That's
who
it.
Want to be kind.
All humans, yeah.
That's good.
It's in very early planning at the moment, but it's never been done in Ireland before.
It's great.
It's a big task. I have an amazing couple of friends who've gotten on board with me. So we've been working secretly in the background about it, getting it planned.
We just get rid of the virus, get a venue, and you're sorted.
I know. I'm hoping it's gone for next year. So it'll probably be, say, June, July of 2021.
Sure.
It'll be open to everyone, as I said. We will, hopefully when I have all the confirmed information, I'll give it to
yourself. Let us know. We'll tell everybody.
Brilliant.
And where can we follow you on Instagram?
Instagram, I'm at Magsie Malou.
Magsie Malou.
Yeah.
I will find you there. And
exactly. So if anybody wants to get in contact about the ball, you know, if they want to do something for us or
play a part, who knows?
Everybody's welcome.
You complete my trilogy of amazing Irish people, young Irish people who we've had on the show this week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yes, amazing stuff.
Offering something different.
Yeah.
Offering a serious subject, shrouded in positivity.
Thank you.
Rather than ranting and raving.
Yeah.
I like your style.
Oh, thanks so much.
So thank you for coming to share your story, Marguerite. And to you and to Michael and Nolene and Kira and your friends, good luck.
Thanks a million.
See you next time. Marguerite, I should say, Penrose. Thanks for coming in tonight. Today even. It's 5 to 10. Laura Egan, good morning.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
It's nice to talk to you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, doing great.
You know, I was watching the movie Greed. I don't know if you've seen Greed, but it's an intriguing take on the fast fashion business.
And all
my education of fast fashion comes from my 21-year-old who is...
Really?
Yeah, no, it's really good, because otherwise I wouldn't be aware of it.
Yeah, completely.
And because I also have secondhand shops, which are now called vintage stores.
Yeah.
As you know. And she was just telling me all about it. So this is something that is completely your bag. Will you tell me about your world?
Yeah. So I am a women's wear designer. I've been working in the fashion industry for the last 4 years. And I've designed for both luxury or high-end brands and high street brands.
Okay.
And I lived in Paris. I lived in London. And Yeah, that was my world for the last 4 years.
And was that when you say I lived in London and Paris as a fashion designer, immediately I'm conjuring up images of champagne parties and runways and extraordinary people with intriguing lifestyles. And was that the world you inhabited?
So I think this is part of the problem, Ryan, is that this is what people think the fashion industry is when you work in it, you know. And even though I was kind of away from the real damage the fashion industry was doing, I was still a part of it. I was still a part of the cycle of waste and of damage that the industry is producing, being a designer. And also, you know, it's not glamorous. The hours are insanely long, and you're not part of the let's say, glamorous side at all working in it. So basically, between Paris and London, I worked in a few brands. And I just saw firsthand the damage that the industry was doing. And, you know, I was guilty of some of it as well. Being a designer, I kind of didn't think about what clothes I was chopping into that couldn't be sold, or what, you know, waste I was putting in the bin that shouldn't have gone in the bin.
Well, before we move on to the next bit, which is Minty, can I ask you about the word you've used several times in the short amount of time we've been talking, which is damage. What damage were you doing? And can you kind of outline that sense of, again, the word damage and the fashion world?
Yeah. So the word damage does cover a whole vast of things in the fashion world. But the ones that I'm kind of focusing on is the waste that is produced, so the actual textile waste that the industry is producing, because I was a part of it. So I might be in a fitting with a model and I would be, you know, putting my design on her that I've had pattern cut and made, and I would be, you know, marking it with a Sharpie and cutting into the hem where it's deemed unsellable. So that alone, that one garment is now in the bin. Mm-hmm. And nobody, you know, and it's from a really good brand, and there's thousands of these and thousands of brands that are doing the same thing. So if I was just one designer in one company, you know, how many others are doing the same? So this was a huge, you know, source.
So waste, is it waste?
Waste, yeah, waste, huge amount of waste. And I felt myself, I just, over the years, I needed to make some sort of change because the guilt was real. So myself, I stopped buying new at the end of last year. So I just cut out any new clothes, any new shoes. So completely dedicated my shopping to charity shops and secondhand.
Okay.
So that was amazing. I mean, I love charity shopping anyway. So and I love it. Like, I collected vintage anyway. So it was kind of it was tough at the beginning, but it wasn't too tough. You know, I liked my charity shop trips. I liked rooting through rails and going to, you know, car boot sales. So it was okay. But then during COVID, I actually lost my job in London.
Okay, I'm sorry, yeah.
So I actually took it as, I was lucky enough to take it as a step to kind of reevaluate what I was doing and take it as a chance to kind of make some sort of change in the fashion industry.
And before I get to your change of your kind of road to Damascus, as it were, you mentioned guilt. What don't you feel guilty of?
I felt guilty because I knew the statistics. I knew how much, you know, I know how much, you know, how much liters it takes to make a cotton t-shirt. And for me to know that information and then to also be on the side seeing it going to landfill, it just didn't sit right with me. I felt guilty because I was the one that was in the position that could do that.
So it wasn't as per the movie I watched, which was a lot of, apart from waste, it was, and that fast fashion thing seems to be largely about waste. But they looked at the conditions of the workers, you know, which were essentially sweatshops.
Yes, yeah. So most of the brands that I worked for were higher end brands. So they weren't necessarily using the same factories as the lower end brands, but not to say that one or two of the brands would have dipped in and out of those factories as well. So there was definitely a guilt in that side as well. But like, for example, one of the brands, I actually went over to the factory that produced for them to work in the factory for 3 weeks, and I saw what the conditions were and I saw everything. So that helped a bit.
And where was that?
But that was in Macau in China.
And what did you see there?
So I saw, they basically, it was our pattern cutters and our sewers, and it was a completely, you know, ethical factory where they were paid the right amount and they were, you know, the conditions were fine for them working. But I hadn't seen, for the other brands I worked for, I'd never seen the factory. So I can't say that for the other
yeah,
companies.
I understand.
And that kind of makes me guilty as well. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of guilt, Laura.
Well, yeah.
But you've got a conscience and I appreciate that. I'm not being cynical about that. So let's bring you then to your loser job in COVID. You're reflecting on the amount of waste and you think, and you've got into your vintage clothes shopping and so on, which sounds actually quite exciting. I'd say if you're a stamp collector, you want to go through, you know, find your stamps, and it's equally for you for clothes, going through boot sales and so on. You suddenly find a diamond, you go, yes. So what next then? What do you do after that?
So during the time of my reflection, I just thought, you know what? People need to be converted to secondhand, but I can understand how intimidating that is for someone who doesn't necessarily like going to charity shops or who doesn't really have much interest in rooting through rails and rails of clothes. So I thought, why not give people a platform where they don't have to go to charity shops, they don't have to leave their house, and start up a pre-loved and vintage clothes online shop. So I started Minty.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
M-I-N-T-I.
M-I-N-T-I.
.ie. Okay.
Yeah.
And what do we find?
Minty.
So what do we find on Minty?
So Minty is a collection of hand-picked pre-loved clothes and vintage clothes, and also Minty offers an upcycling service. So this has been a massive, this has been really popular, where I take people's clothes and I change them into something new. So a lot of people have wanted this because they have those clothes in the wardrobe that they don't wear, or they're thinking, you know, I would wear it if it was, it might be a dress, I would wear it if it was a skirt or a skirt and a top.
Yeah.
So I can take your clothes and I can change them into something else.
You reimagine that humdrum piece hanging on a hanger that everyone looks at and goes, God, every time I see it, I don't want to throw it out, and yet it kind of does nothing for me. You say, I can bring the magic.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Exactly.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And there's no way, nothing ends up in the infill, the landfill.
No, that's the thing. And the way I always, so my design now, because I can bring in the design element where I can actually offer designs for them, and I design sustainably. So I try design with zero waste, which is difficult, but it's also really challenging for me, and it allows them to feel great wearing it as well.
It sounds like you have this sorted out. And your conscience? It must be crystal clear, is it?
Oh, it's completely clear now. It's amazing.
And are you operating at a home? Or do you have an office now or a workplace?
So I have a home office at the moment.
Great.
But I'm hoping actually in September to start up with workshops and classes on upcycling and sewing. So at that point, I'll be moving to a studio, hopefully, where people can actually learn how to upcycle themselves.
It's a great idea. And it's a great lesson. What I love about your story, Laura, is that it's that lovely sense of COVIDian reinvention and seeing the changing landscape and fixing it. We'll all benefit from what you're doing as well. So I can only wish you the very best.
Oh, thank you so much.
No, I love it. I think it's really, really good. And I need to be honest with you, I'm not there yet. I'm not going to be a hypocrite and say, you know, I'd buy all my clothes secondhand. I don't.
Yeah.
But what I am, what you have done is triggered a consciousness about it that I hadn't before. So, so that's a start,
great.
Right? So,
start, yeah.
But I think for your generation are much more savvy and connected to this idea of fast fashion. Yeah, it does seem that way. And that makes the future brighter. So, Laura, I wish you the very best with Minty.ie and I appreciate you coming on this morning. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Ryan.
You, Laura.
Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise. Okay, Laura Egan joining us on the subject of fast fashion. It's funny, you could sit down and watch a movie, you know, and it just gets into these brings down these avenues and streets you didn't expect in a given week. But it's a great old movie called Greed with Steve Coogan and a cast of, obviously not thousands, but hundreds. Lots of interesting cameos and cracking script directed by Michael Winterbottom. Comes highly recommended.